This is the November 18 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Kerry Siparath. He is with U.S. Grains Council. And Ryan Kilbrands, a commodity broker with CHS Hedging. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Our program today comes from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. Don't forget that on Monday, we'll hold our own conference, the Farm Assets Conference, at the iHotel in Champaign. You can join us starting at 8:30. Walk-ins are welcome still. The cost is $90. Now, we'll start today with Kerry Siparath, again with U.S. Grains Council.
Well, we're always looking at what market access and making sure our products have access to those global markets, whether that's tariff and logistical issues with we've been dealing with through COVID, and now even after coming out of COVID with the low river issues and what that's doing with the ability to move products down the river to the export markets.
How much have you been thinking about the river issues and how to mitigate them potentially, or what issues it really creates?
Well, short of me making it rain, that's and we've seen some rain, and we're seeing river levels come up a bit. You know, heard reports of it coming up at St. Louis and Memphis and further down, we're still a long ways from. But you know, and trying to keep, the barges moving as best they can. And then just working with international customers on other options. You know, we can move grain out of the U.S. Through the lake systems, off the West Coast, off the Pacific Northwest. And the area we have seen, and we move a lot of DDGS in containers, and other products, corn and other grains can, and we had some container logistic issues during COVID, and those have come back to normal. Our container availability and container prices are back to more normal ranges, and so we're seeing more interest even in shipping DDGS or even corn to certain markets in containers.
They would have to be high value markets for the corn, I would assume.
Not necessarily. I mean, we have, you know, you've got, especially in markets out in Asia where you're getting decent backhaul rates for containers. You know, they want those empty containers back out into Taiwan, Korea, southern China, across Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines. And so that's a natural area where we're shipping products in containers. A lot of DDGS, our second or third largest DDGS markets, Vietnam and South Korea, take predominantly, if not all of that, in containers. A lot of that getting loaded right there in Joliet, Illinois, is one of the big hubs there. But we see the Taiwanese have taken corn in containers on a fairly regular basis, and that's now that those container availabilities are coming back, we're seeing them starting to ship more in containers. But even other markets in that Asia-Pacific region where container freight makes more sense, that they can take advantage of that. Now, it's if I wanting to replace a 60,000-ton vessel all in containers, it takes a lot of containers. So it's not a complete replacement, but we are seeing some increase in movement that way.
A rail strike has been on the loom of the horizon for the better part of a year. That keeps being pushed back. I think the last date is something like December 9th. How much of a concern is it for the export market and for the U.S. Grains Council?
It's a big concern. We're watching it. We have the U.S. Grain Council doesn't lobby, so we have other of our members and associations that we work with that do that. But yeah, I mean it's concerning whether I'm moving grain out to the Pacific Northwest, or if I'm moving it to the Texas Gulf, or I'm trying to move it to the river, or I'm even just trying to move grain from the Eastern Corn Belt to the Western Corn Belt where they've gotten some shortages, or I'm trying to move ethanol out of plants, DDGS out of plants. It's all rail related there, both domestically and the international market. So I think the grain sector is very, very nervous about it. You know, a predominant amount of our corn going to Mexico is going by rail. And so, yeah, having a solution to that as we get closer to that new date now in December is something that the whole industry, both on a domestic and an international side of things, is watching very closely.
Knowing full well that that's a domestic issue that does have an impact on the export market, particularly to the number one corn export market for the United States of Mexico, I would like to ask about that nation. They have been posturing now for a while that they're not wanting to take genetically modified products, corn in particular. I'm wondering how much of an issue that is. I know that it's a big one. And how the United States U.S. Grains Council is trying to make its way through it.
Yeah, I mean, President AMLO there in Mexico, he came out with his presidential decree back in December 31st of 2020 that they were going to ban the use of glyphosate and the importation of GMO corn by January 2024. We're now getting closer and closer to that January 2024 date, which has heightened all this. Since that decree was announced, we've been working with our partners in the Mexican industry as well as other associations here in the U.S. to work on it and deal with it. We've been in discussions and trying to resolve that issue. I know the Biden administration is looking at that as well and talking to Mexicans. And so hopefully that gets resolved. I don't know that Mexico can survive without importing, whether if certain sectors of their market want to go to a non-GMO thing, that's possible. It's virtually impossible for them to do it 100% replacement. They've talked about, well, we're going to become self-sufficient. In the 2 years since the decree, they're basically remaining steady at their own domestic production, which it's still, I think they produce 27 million tons of their own corn, but they're still needing to import 16 or 17 million tons, predominantly from the U.S., to meet their growing demand, especially for their livestock, feed and livestock industry, but also their corn processing sector. And we do see some white corn from the U.S., that goes into Mexico for the tortilla and food uses down there.
I would not think it would be easily possible if they were to ban all GM products to turn, for instance, to Brazil for its safrinha or second crop corn, because it clearly will also be genetically modified.
Correct. Whether it's, and we're seeing a little Brazilian and Argentine corn coming to Mexico because of the price advantage right at the moment. And it's not large amounts, but yeah, you can't really rely on Brazil or Argentina to supply non-GMO corn. And Mazol, which is in a group that U.S. Grain Council helped put together and work with, so that's the corn producers in Brazil and Argentina and the U.S., that both U.S. Grain Council and the National Corn Growers Association are involved in. And we brought a delegation of Mazol to Mexico for several months to basically send that message. The three largest corn producers and exporters in the world are going to continue to use GM events because it benefits the farmers' profitability. It helps sustainability issues that the world wants us to move towards. And so they, the three largest exporters are not going to make major adjustments to producing non-GMO corn for that Mexican market. So that, I think that message has been sent already, but it has not resolved the issue. We'll continue to work with our partners both in the U.S. here and down in Mexico to help overcome that issue as we get closer to that January 24th deadline.
I have one more question on the Mexico issue, because this is a two-track issue as it comes back to us, either as food-grade ban on GM or feed-grain all ban on GM. And I take it depends on which official you're talking to in Mexico.
Correct. Their Minister of Ag Agriculture has said that it would only be, yellow corn for the feed industry wouldn't be affected. Other parts of the AMLO government, including himself, have said it's going to be for all corn. We're just moving forward, assuming the worst, that they're aiming it at all corn and not saying we'll let the yellow corn for feed side come in. But between the white corn that we ship down to Mexico, as well as the yellow corn that goes down there for corn processing, that's a good 3.5 million metric tons of corn a year. And so that's still a big, big market. It's not, you know, it's not just a few rail cars loads every year. It's a big, big portion of the corn imports. And just yesterday, the big corn one of the big corn processors in Mexico does their normally buys a big chunk of corn at one time. And so we saw them come in. USDA announced a 1.87 million metric ton buying. So that's 73.6 million bushels. Of that, 49 million bushels were for the current marketing year. And 24.6 of that is for the 23-24 marketing year. So now that's even looking at moving into that 20 after the decree would most likely fall into place if they continue to move forward with it. So I guess that's a good positive sign that one of the big corn processors down there is still going ahead with their normal buying, big buying purchase, and it's the largest we've seen them ever buy when they announced that yesterday. So it's a good sign that the industry in Mexico is still moving ahead with plans of, you know, we need corn from the U.S. To feed our livestock and run our feed industry, and we need corn from the U.S. to run our corn processing sector for starch and sweeteners, just like we have here in the U.S. And so at least the Mexican industry is still moving forward, but I'm sure I know they're still worried about it, and we continue to work with them to try and overcome that issue.
We think of China a lot of times as mostly a soybean importer from the United States. However, they do import other products, corn, sorghum, some other things. Have you been assessing COVID's impact on their economy, what that means going forward?
And we have an office in Beijing. We have our new American director on the ground there now. The 2020-21 marketing year, we saw China come in as the largest buyer of U.S. corn, the largest 21.4 million tons, the largest amount of corn we've ever exported to any one country. The last marketing year, it backed down to, 14.7 million metric tons or 578 million bushels. And they're still buying and we're shipping corn there now. They have been our biggest, since 2014, our biggest importer of U.S. sorghum. They're a big feed grain demand between the corn and sorghum. They have an anti-dumping countervailing duty case on U.S. DDGS, which has slowed that way down. But there is still some product U.S. DDGS still shipping to China, so it's a big and important market. Their COVID restrictions and has had an effect on their economy, has slowed things down. Whether that's slowing, you know, food demand and livestock demand is possible. Although we're seeing pork prices pick back up, so demand for feed and feed ingredients for the pork industry is picking back up. Long term, we'll have to see how China continues to deal with that. Hints of they may start opening things up, but we'll have to watch that going forward as to what that does to overall demand for U.S. agricultural products. Obviously, big, big soybean market, but yeah, it's still a big market for U.S. corn and U.S. sorghum as well.
Lastly, I'd like to turn our attention to the Black Sea region, the grain corridor, Russia, Ukraine, and the war there. The impact it has had since the war began earlier in the year on the marketplace and what the expectations for this grain corridor might be going forward.
Yeah, it looks like early this morning over there in the region, they with the UN, they were able to renegotiate at least an extension, from what I understand, of 120 days. So it extends. It was set to run out this basically midnight on Friday of this week. So that extends it for another 120 days. Still the same three ports in Ukraine only. And so that at least, I think the way we've seen the market move already this morning, that the market was already expecting that to happen. We didn't see wheat prices drop off quite a bit. So it's, but it's key. We've seen Russia say they're in and they're out and change within 48 hours. And so there's still some nervousness. There's still, you know, vessel owners and insurance companies are still putting premiums on sending vessels into the Black Sea region. And so it's still a lot of uncertainty that's going to weigh on global grain supplies and then thus prices. But having that open for another 120 days, I think, gives some relief to markets. But, you know, you look at a market like Egypt that's a big buyer of wheat and corn, gets a lot of that usually from the Black Sea, whether it's Russia or Ukraine. And Egypt's been going through some difficult times. So, and we'd love to sell U.S. corn to Egypt, but at the same time, if they can get some lower cost Ukrainian corn at the moment, and it keeps the poultry and livestock and feed industry in Egypt alive, that means there's an industry for us to work with, whether it's a year or two from now in Egypt. Even though you may say, well, it may hurt U.S. market share in some of these markets, it's actually maybe a lifesaver for some of those markets, for them to even be alive, for us to be able to compete in that market with the strong dollar and the currency issues that especially countries like Egypt are having. I think it'll be a big saving grace for them.
Kerry Siparath is the vice president with the U.S. Grains Council. Now, let's turn our attention to Ryan Kilbrants. He is with CHS Hedging.
So tell me what you do on a daily basis.
I don't sleep much in the last couple of years. I analyze markets. I monitor new USDA reports. I follow many news agencies. We subscribe to a number of different public or private communications about markets, and look at what is affecting the markets and how it's going to affect the markets, and in the future what may happen due to that information that we're receiving.
And broadly, can you explain what CHS does as a company?
We're an energy and agriculture company. We have crushing facilities, Fairmont and Mankato. We crush soybeans. We export grains through the Gulf of Mexico and the PNW. We have facilities throughout the world, and our job is to help our farmer members grow.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the export side of this for the moment, because you do have a facility at the PNW, which we talk about often as it's related to soybeans, I suppose wheat and corn to some extent. How busy has it been exporting out of that facility?
We've been exporting out of the PNW. Beans, a lot of beans go out of the PNW, wheat, corn. There's been some issues with the river recently, due to low river levels, out of the Gulf too. So we've been watching the potential strike between the railroads. They've got a cooling off period that's extended through early December. That's something that we're watching. We're trying to more efficiently and effectively move stuff out of the PNW for export.
How do you manage that? Because you really need the railways to pull that off, but there's probably a lot of logistics to be put in place with the BNSF, if I remember correctly, for the rail.
The rail is a huge factor in our exports. Not CHS, but North Dakota, they'll ship, 70% of their beans to the PNW to China. So, having that ability and the logistics to move that grain is going to be very important moving forward. And that's hopefully that the unions and the railroad can work together to come up with a solution, because it would be, the impact on our economy would be detrimental, and it would be up to a couple $1 billion a day in lost revenue if we lose that logistics chain.
So I'm building back into the Midwest, into Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, the Eastern Corn Belt, from the Western Corn Belt to start with here, thinking about the PNW being a primary shipping point to China, the low Mississippi River levels, which aren't likely to come back up very quickly, being a choke point as the barge traffic is limited in terms of what it can carry, and freight is, of course, going up. And then the short supply of corn and soybeans in that Western Corn Belt, and the need domestically and internationally to move grains and oil seeds westward. This all must be a nightmare for a company like CHS to have to think about.
I think a nightmare, more of a challenge, more concerns. There's a lot of people working on solutions to get those figured out, and it's not an easy thing to do, but we have people in place that have been trained, that have experience, that have the ability to, make things work. So I'm hopeful that we can get things going again. Hopefully the river levels will continue to rise and we can get those channels open, you know. Weather's going to dictate that. But I think we're definitely on the right path of figuring out some of these challenges.
On the local level, how do you see basis from the western to the eastern Corn Belt moving through the winter months?
I think basis stays strong. We've got good crush. You know, the crush margins are excellent. The ethanol margins have decreased recently, but production remains stable, strong. We saw a little bit of a drop in ethanol stocks this last week. Driving in the U.S. remains strong, 8 million barrels a day plus. So I think that basis levels are going to stay firm.
Domestically, we are short both of soybeans and corn, although soybeans are mostly exported. So on the basis level internally, it'll be interesting to see how that happens and what takes place after January. Corn, however, is short, and it really won't be replaced until we get to the fall of next year. Are you supportive of corn prices going forward, or feeling as if the world market might constrain how much upside there is left, given the current high price?
True. Good question. Right now, I think that the markets are focusing on South America. They're looking at the weather patterns down there. Argentina early on had some issues with their corn and wheat areas. There's some production numbers there that may be a little bit smaller. We did see a nice increase in yields for both corn and beans in this last USDA report in November, which is a positive. The weather in Brazil is going to be a focus of the market, definitely. So far, so good. Things have looked good so far, but it's still very early in the season. They've got that first corn crop in the ground. They got the beans in the ground. They're looking at 150 million metric ton crop or better. We're going to keep a close eye on the weather down there. Basis levels here, I think they're going to stay strong. We're figuring out kind of a area where we're trading corn, and it seems like $7 has been a kind of a top. It doesn't seem to hold there in the front month. And then, you know, $6.50 or a little bit less than that has kind of been the sweet spot for corn.
What do you tell producers who have put a crop in the bin, whether it's at home or in the elevator? They've already paid the in charge, so it's too late on that one, to do with the crop, because most of them simply close that door and they're going to wait it out at this point.
Yeah, good question. The question that I have is are they marketing some stuff for next year? At what price levels will they open that bin door, and where will they start to sell some of that crop? You know, will it be after the first of the year? You know, there's some ideas that after the first of the year, we're going to see a little bit more grain move out of the farmers' hands. I wouldn't be surprised if we did. But I think that it's going to remain tight. I mean, we have a stocks in the United States of beans of, you know, went from 200 to 220 million bushels. That's a tight pipeline. You know, we've got some of these biodiesel plants coming on board pretty soon, and they're working on them right now. That's going to be another demand pull for beans. I think that's going to support the bean market as well.
Is there any demand destruction that's really taking place yet in the marketplace, given the high price of both corn and soybeans, whether that be in the export market, livestock? Ethanol tends to simply be a part of the gasoline supply, so it stays pretty steady.
I don't see the demand destruction coming anytime soon. You know what I mean? I think that the demand is there, and then that's going to continue as we move forward. And I think that, you know, the farmers, you know, they have the ability to store a lot of crop on farm and to take advantage of some of these higher prices on the basis, strengthen the basis.
So you suggested that they need to be thinking about next year's crop and sales. I assume that was for corn as it's related to input prices. What about for soybean?
I think soybeans are on the same page. You know, you're going to have higher input costs. Energy costs are going up. Inflation, you know, everything's getting a little more expensive. So your input costs are going to rise. But if you're looking at, you know, $14 to $15 beans, that reflects in a higher commodity price, and that benefits the farmer as well.
Right now, today, if you had to make a bet, will the fall price of corn and soybeans, I know this is really tough, but will the fall price 2023 of corn and soybeans be lower than today and or the February crop insurance setting month?
Interesting question. There's a lot of factors that are going to play into that. We've got, you know, issues in the Black Sea. Is that corridor going to remain open? You know, we heard overnight that, you know, they're going to extend the Black Sea grain export agreement for a few months. We have to keep a really close eye on what's going there. We're trading headlines. We saw a missile cross a border into Poland. Markets took off directly in response to that. We had a sell-off the last couple days. It's going to be interesting moving forward, higher or lower. You know, there's going to be a number of factors that are going to dictate that. We've seen a number of black swan events the last couple of years. Nobody can predict those. I think that markets are going to stay firm. I think that the corn and bean market are trying to find that fair price with the input costs. You know, rents are rising, values on farmland are increasing. That's going to play a factor into where we're going. We're going to look at how many acres we're going to plant this spring. That's going to be dictated by, you know, price in some circumstances. You know, there's farmers that are going to stick with rotations, but I think we're going to see some shifts, you know, just due to the demand from these biodiesel plants coming up. I think the farmers are in a good situation because the demand is going to stay strong, and we should see support on these prices.
Ryan Kilbrands is a commodity broker with CHS Hedging. He and Kerry Sifferath joined us at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You can find and listen to this program anytime you'd like in its entirety online at willag.org or search it out in your favorite podcast application. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.